Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. WikiLeaks has released the largest trove ever of documents from the CIA, a batch of thousands of documents codenamed Vault 7. It shows that the agency has the ability to hack into virtually all popular encryption apps. Is there nowhere to hide from illegal government spying? Republicans have released their plan to replace Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act this week. Are millions of people about to lose health insurance? Today, International Women's Day is being marked around the world, including in many countries where it is a national holiday. But here in the United States, organizers are planning a major series of demonstrations and strikes. But first, we turn to the Vault 7 release. We are joined by John Whitehead, an attorney and founder of the Rutherford Institute. He is the author of several books, including A Government of Wolves, The Emerging American Police State. Welcome, John.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
John Whitehead, what is Vault 7? What are the implications for cybersecurity and privacy? This has obviously been dominating the media ever since yesterday when it was released. The New York Times calls it perhaps one of the most serious breaches in CIA history. Go ahead.
Well, what it shows is the CIA has the ability, but this is something I've known for many years, by the way, that they have the ability to hack into everything, all your devices. They've been, you know, working with private hackers around the world in the United States. So what we're being told is just one more step in the ladder, because as I've written about in my books, like you said, Government of Wolves, my latest book is Battlefield America, The War on the American People. Everything you're doing is being watched. I liken it to us human beings now, trapped in a huge bubble, as if it's a dome, and that dome is looking at us all the time and whatever we can do. And if you want to go through some of the things, I mean, the NSA downloads almost 2 billion emails daily. They work with the CIA, so the CIA has been doing it as well. All your text messages, your Twitter, Facebook pages are all looked at, analyzed, according to what they want to target as extremists. I don't know if you remember back in 2009, under the Obama administration, two reports were issued on right-wing extremism and left-wing extremism, what the government committed to, considered to be extremists. When I looked at that, I saw right away what it meant. Anybody that opposes government, a show like this where we're talking about real issues, puts you on the list to be an extremist, to be watched and controlled. And we've had a number of cases where people have been contacted by the NSA and CIA for simply doing emails, doing Facebook posts. Some have been jailed, and we've helped them get out of jail based on the fact that the CIA, the FBI, they all work together, by the way, the NSA, to watch everything we're doing. And the Department of Homeland Security now has moved one of their major headquarters out of Silicon Valley, where they work with Google, Amazon, Facebook, and all the major corporations, again with the CIA, NSA, to watch everything we're doing. So, folks, what I'm saying is we're trapped now. That's my opinion. We're trapped like rats. And not only that, but how many people know that the post office records 160 billion pieces of mail annually? They're going through our mail. They're x-raying our mail, seeing what we're doing in our regular mail. So it isn't just electronics. Speakers in your room, your television set right now, all that can be hacked into, and they become devices. So this is not a new revelation. The only thing it is just, in my point of view, one more step in the ladder of total surveillance. And I'll be honest with you, I think we're in a total surveillance state at this point.
The New York Times wrote yesterday, right after the release was made public, quote, among other disclosures that, if confirmed, would rock the technology world, the WikiLeaks release said that the CIA and allied intelligence services had managed to bypass encryption on popular phone and messaging services such as Signal, WhatsApp, and Telegram. Now, those became a big point, especially after the election. A lot of people wanted to go to Signal. A lot of people did go to Signal. They downloaded that app. They downloaded WhatsApp. They thought, okay, now I'm going to be protected from the government. These were people who were opponents of Trump before. If you were an opponent of Obama, you might have been doing the same thing. In other words, people who feel that they might be targeted or that the government is involved in extreme overreach, they were relying on these encrypted tools to protect them. But in essence, what we're learning from Vault 7 release is that that's just not true.
It's not true, no. Everything you're doing is being watched. And like I'm saying, the major corporations work intimately with Google included, but Amazon, and I've written about this, Amazon built, with $600 million of taxpayer money, built an intelligence cloud for all the intelligence agencies, which, by the way, allow groups like Netflix, large corporations, they have access to that cloud. We don't. So they're all intimately connected. So everything you're watching, and how many people realize, and I've written on this, fusion centers across the United States, there are rooms filled with cameras, TV sets, and screen devices watching everything we're doing. Now in some major cities, most major cities, they have real-time crime centers that when you enter the city, everything you're doing on your laptop, your cell phone, whatever, is being watched. And let me add one more thing to this. I have friends who say, hey, I'm just going to get off the web, you know, and go out in the woods and live. And I say, well, if you happen to open up just your laptop to play a game, the FBI admitted several years ago they can hack into that and it becomes a camera and your cell phone becomes a listening device. Add to that the drones, which will be flying over your house and already are collecting information. So like I said, we're in a large, huge, monstrous bubble zone right now. And here's the really sad thing about all this. They treat us like we're lab rats. They're watching us. They're trying to figure out how to control us, how to sell us products, how to pitch things at us. And like I said, I mean, we defended a decorated Marine who was doing anti-Obama Facebook posts. They arrested him. He wound up in a mental hospital. We filed a lawsuit and got him out. But incredibly, we found out that they were watching everything he was doing, everything electronically, including he was playing a private Facebook video game, private, and they actually hacked into that. So they can hack into anything, in my opinion. Like I said, your speakers, your television sets, everything is listening to you folks.
And who is they? Who is they?
It's the government. The people calling it the deep state, but it's the intelligence agencies. And this is the key point to they. Google has million-dollar contracts at NSA. Amazon, Facebook, all these social media groups that are out there, they're working with the government as well. So there's nothing, and I'm being honest with you, there's nothing that you're doing. If you're driving along in your car and you're mad at the driver, you start saying it on, I'd like to kick his butt or take a gun and shoot him, you realize if your cell phone's there in your car, they're listening. It's not paranoia anymore. This latest Vault 7 leaks shows exactly what they are and what they think. Again, they don't view us as total human beings, and that's really offensive.
Of course, the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, all of the intelligence agencies, and the politicians in Congress all act as if what these agencies are doing is protecting the people of the United States, defending security. Security becomes the rationale for all things that the intelligence company and so-called community does, both the things that we know about and then the things that we don't know about, but we find out about because of revelations. Talk about it from your point of view as an attorney, as a civil libertarian. How do you deal with the issue that the rationale given for this is security? Is it making the country, quote, safer?
Well, I mean, you had 9/11. We still have terrorist attacks occasionally in the United States. But, you know, the point is, are they really, you know, what are they doing here constitutionally? And this is what most citizens don't understand the Constitution. They are completely violating the Constitution. The Fourth Amendment says in order for the government to do surveillance on you at all, they have to have probable cause. That means some evidence of illegality. Well, if the NSA is downloading just one of their programs, almost 2 billion emails a day, and looking at everything we're doing, they're violating the Fourth Amendment. And no one's standing up to them, by the way. I don't see any president that has stood up and said, hey, stop this stuff. Stop violating the Constitution. We're going to get reform. I don't see any congressman saying that. I don't see anybody in Congress. And again, I don't see the American people screaming. We should be screaming down the throats of these so-called people who sit in Congress and do nothing and watch this go by. So I think there is hope that we can change it somewhat, but I'm afraid with what the police are armed with now, I don't know if you saw recently the cameras all the cops are going to be wearing. Right now, most of them have facial recognition software. They're watching you walk down the street. They can identify you no matter what. they have stingray devices in their cars handed out to them by the federal government that drive by your home and don't download everything on your computer and your cell phone. That's all unconstitutional. The courts are quiet. But unless the American people, like we the people, get up off our butts and turn part of the television time off and get active, I don't see much hope for this. You're going to get arrested for minor offenses coming soon, folks, because like I say, we see the cases.
The New York Times, again, in its article notes, quote, one codenamed Weeping Angel uses Samsung smart televisions as covert listening devices.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Yes, I knew that. That's been happening for quite a while. Yeah, your television set, generally most of your new, your Vizios, they're listening devices and they become screen devices. Like I said, and the key was when Comey, the head of the FBI, was doing a press conference, he actually mentioned slipped. I think this was actually a slip or a warning. He said he covered up the camera on his laptop. Now, why would he be doing that? Because he knows what it is. It's a camera. So they can, you're being watched. I mean, Elf on a Shelf, anything with the kids, your speakers in your home. I mean, I'm telling you, folks, we're in a total dome right now, and it's cyber warfare against the American citizen.
Right. We hear all the news from the past months about how Russia is interfering in the election process. Of course, Clapper, who was in charge of intelligence, said the other day when he was on Meet the Press, there is no evidence of collusion between the Trump election campaign and Russia. That was actually last Sunday. He said no collusion. When you listen to NPR or any of the media, the term collusion between Trump and Russia or Russia hacking, it's just assumed, it's asserted and then believed. There's no actual evidence, though, according to the intelligence agencies, but it becomes useful. It seems to me, John Whitehead, that this perhaps, too, is a policy of distraction, not just about electoral politics or the narrow issues of who won, who lost, Republican, Democrat, but the idea that the U.S. government is really imperiled by foreign intelligence. And what you're really saying is if you believe in the Constitution, if you believe the Fourth Amendment is essential to democracy, if you believe that the government has no right to stop you and read your communication or interfere with you without probable cause, it would seem to me that the distraction here is away from our own government or the government that speaks in our name, at least.
Oh, that's obvious. But listen, the point is, and I'll go back and say it again, anytime these politicians speak, and I always say, you know, again, politicians and Clapper's a politician, they're all like that. Don't trust a word they say. What did James Madison say, who wrote our Bill of Rights? We ought to mistrust all those in power. When you start actually trusting the politicians in our government, which have been crooks, many of them for many years, they don't even represent us. They let the president conduct wars unconstitutionally. They don't do anything to stop any of that. Are they really guarding our rights? Of course they're not, because they're part of, you want to call it the deep state? I call it the corporate state. Remember that 2014 Princeton study that came out that they analyzed 20 years of laws and policies passed in Washington, D.C., and the professors came to the conclusion that we live in a moneyed elite, an oligarchy run by a moneyed elite. And by the way, Jimmy Carter, several months later, agreed we're ruled by an oligarchy. And that oligarchy is not going to tell you, yes, we're spying on everything you're doing. Yeah, we shouldn't be doing that. No, what do they want? They want control. And that's the ultimate measure of governments that are illegitimate. And I believe the government we have, and I'll just say it, is operating illegitimately outside the bounds of the Constitution. But whose job is it to hold them accountable? It's called we the people.
Yeah, we're talking with John Whitehead. He's a author and attorney, civil libertarian. He's been exposing the atrocities, really, the abuse by the so-called intelligence community, and I don't know why we call it a community. I mean, that sounds so benign. These are major hierarchical military organizations that are directing their efforts.
And working with corporate entities. Yeah.
And working with corporate entities. John, in its press release, WikiLeaks, which was, the entity that released the Vault 7 documents, quote, said this, and this is another piece of this that I want to ask you about. Recently, the CIA lost control of the majority of its hacking arsenal, including malware, viruses, trojans, weaponized, quote, zero-day, close quote, exploits, malware, remote control systems, and associated documentation. This extraordinary collection, which amounts to more than several hundred million lines of code, gives its possessor the entire hacking capacity of the CIA. Is there a danger, obviously this is what WikiLeaks is suggesting, of the cyber weapons that the CIA and other intelligence organizations have proliferating now across the globe. I mean, they really can't control. This is like the genie's out of the bottle almost.
I think the genie's out of the bottle. I was going to say the demon's out of the bottle, yes. And no, there's no way. I mean, there's so much stuff going out there. And some of the young students that I work with, sometimes in my intern program, some of them are very adept. Some even say their side job is hacking. I mean, there's a lot of people out there hacking. The information is being collected illegitimate, like I said, and they're serving it up to people who will have some interests that are not suitable to, again, the American people. Again, it can be clamped down on if the government would do its job, but the government wants to collect the information. They want to control us. They want to use our money. And remember, the CIA, NSA all have black budgets. We don't know who their employees are, how many they have. Here's the problem. The people who wrote our Constitution wanted a government that was transparent. We knew what they were doing, what their budget was. They wanted to make sure if the president did a war, Congress approved. They're not doing any of that now. We no longer have a democracy, a representative republic. What we have is a state, basically, that's cyber-controlled and is going to conduct cyber warfare. Are they sometimes stupid and bumbling? Yes, because I've met some of them. And I've met former NSA agents that tell me the same thing. They worry because of what's going on, that the whole system could collapse. And, by the way, I've written on this. There's a video that the Pentagon put out. If you haven't seen it, your listeners should. I wrote on it. You go to our website and click on it. It's a five-minute video predicting by 2030 the whole country's going to break down totally, and the Pentagon's going to have to impose martial law. So they have a plan, so watch out.
Yeah, we would need some triggering events, but they're always readily at hand. We're going to have to leave it right there. We've been joined by John Whitehead. He's an attorney and founder of the Rutherford Institute. He is the author of several books, including A Government of Wolves, The Emerging American Police State. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Republicans have released their plan to replace the Affordable Health Care Act, the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Are millions of people about to lose their health insurance? We are joined by Dr. Margaret Flowers. She is the co-director of Popular Resistance, as well as a pediatrician and an advocate for single-payer health care. Welcome back, Margaret.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
Thank you. Republicans have rolled out their plan to replace Obamacare. House Speaker Paul Ryan said Obamacare is, quote, rapidly collapsing, and it is time to turn the page, adding, the American Health Care Act is a plan to drive down costs, encourage competition, and give every American access to quality, affordable health care insurance. It protects young adults, patients with pre-existing conditions, and provides a stable transition so that no one has the rug pulled out from under them. Is that accurate?
No, there's so much to unpack in that statement. I mean, first, very basic thing is that having access to purchase health insurance doesn't mean that you'll be able to actually purchase it, or that once you purchase it, you'll have access to care. So there's a lot of twisting in language there.
Right, and that would have been true even under the Obamacare, under the Affordable Care Act, because people could get, in some cases, with subsidies, in some cases, health care, but the deductibles were so high, people would never dare to use it because it would be $1,800 or $2,500 or $5,000 that you had to pay out of pocket before, I'm talking about some plans, before you could even start to access your insurance benefits.
Right, right. And that was the problem of basing a health system on private health insurance because their primary responsibility is to make a profit for their investors by charging the highest premiums they can, shifting as much of the cost as they can onto people, and then denying and restricting payment for care. So we continue to see tens of millions of people who are underinsured and can't use the health insurance they have.
What's the basic difference between this plan and the Affordable Care Act? Of course, we'll still have to read it in great detail and analyze it. But from what you've been able to read so far, what are the basic differences?
Yeah, what's interesting, and I think this is actually very clever, is that they're kind of saying that they're not really repealing the Affordable Care Act. They're just changing some of the provisions within it. And so there are aspects of it that are popular with people, even though they don't completely solve the problem of, you know, so-called covering pre-existing conditions, although that's not always, doesn't always work, allowing children to stay on until age 26 and capping some of the, taking away the lifetime caps, getting rid of the, or having out-of-pocket caps. Those things are fairly popular, and it would be kind of political suicide for Republicans to get rid of them. What they are doing, though, is they're kind of driving insurance down. It already has been driven down in terms of what, how much it covers, you know, where the bottom plans cover 60% of covered expenses. Now they're saying that those insurers can sell plans that cover even less than that. That's a big problem because that leaves patients vulnerable. So these plans that they're kind of going to be pushing will be plans that are very cheap, but work even worse than the ones that we have right now because of the high out-of-pocket costs that people are going to have up front. And they're taking away the subsidies that we have right now that help people purchase private insurance and replacing them with tax credits, which don't help the majority of people in this country who don't have the money on hand to pay the premiums and can't wait for a tax credit to do that.
When Obama introduced this plan back in 2009, it was right after he announced that a single-payer health plan was off the table, to put it in his words. That was after the New York Times had released a survey that showed that more than 70% of the American people actually favored single-payer health, which is similar to Medicare, but it would be Medicare for all people. He said it's off the table. He introduced the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. The Republicans immediately treated it as communism and or socialism and said that that became their number one banner, repeal Obamacare. And, of course, for 8 years, they've been demanding the repeal of Obamacare as if it's repealing this government-imposed socialist-type program against an unwilling public. But the fact of the matter is that people are coerced in all kinds of ways because of healthcare. Everyone needs to go to a doctor. Eventually, your kids need to go to a doctor. In the old system, if you had a pre-existing condition, the healthcare insurance companies will just say, well, we're not covering you. Also, kids, once they became, I think, 18, they had to go get their own plans. Maybe 50 million people did not have healthcare in the United States. Paul Ryan says about this new Republican plan to replace Affordable Care Act with all of its flaws. I want to read this amazing quote to you. Quote, working together, this unified Republican government will deliver relief and peace of mind to the millions of Americans suffering under Obamacare. What's your reaction to that?
Well, first, I don't think the Republicans are terribly unified, so it's going to be interesting to see, you know, if they're able to come together to pass something, you know, especially on this very accelerated timeline that they're trying to use through the budget reconciliation process. You know, we're already seeing that the Freedom Caucus, the kind of Tea Party part of the House, is against it because it's not free market enough for them. And we're seeing some of the senators, Republican senators, that are starting to get cold feet and back away from this. So I don't think there's a tremendous amount of unity there. And what we're going to continue to see is an erosion in insurance coverage. People who are either unable to afford private health insurance or will be have the insurance and not be able to use it when they get sick. We're going to continue to see high rates of medical bankruptcies, which we're still seeing now under the Affordable Care Act. People are losing their homes, going bankrupt from medical debt. And we're going to see that our safety net program, Medicaid for the poor, is going to be eroded as well through the way that they're going to be financing it is going to be inadequate over time. We're just going to see that plan deteriorate over the years. So our most vulnerable people are really going to be continue to experience difficulties under this plan.
Dr. Flowers, it used to be that politicians would try to hypocritically and demagogically, but nonetheless try to promise their constituency that their life would get better once they elected whoever it was who was making promises to them. But here you have the Republican Party actually promising at least big parts of it, like the Club for Growth or the whatever it's called, the Freedom Caucus. they're actually promising people that they're going to reduce their living standards. They're going to reduce their benefits. How does that make any sense, even from a narrow political point of view?
Yeah, I mean, I just see this as really committing political suicide. And what's been really interesting, you know, last week, members of Congress were home and there were town halls all around the country. And we really saw people coming out, even in very conservative districts, pushing on the members of Congress and saying, you've got to make sure that we have access to health care. And a couple of the town halls where I was on the panel that were in rural conservative Republican districts actually turned into panels on how do we get national improved Medicare for all. So it's, the people are in a very different place, as they often are, than the politicians. And this is a big one for people. Health care, you know, directly impacts people and the people they love.
Where were you?
I was on the Eastern Shore in Salisbury and then out in Carroll County.
So these are rural, more conservative parts of the state of Maryland. The state of Maryland overall voted for Clinton, but those areas probably voted Trump.
Right. And they have our only Republican congressman in Congress, you know, from Maryland.
I think that's extremely interesting, and it will be extremely interesting for our audience because when push comes to shove, during the election campaign, the politicians can say whatever they want to people. They can appeal to people, say, let's stop immigrants, or in the case of the Democrats, let's stop Russia. But at the end of the day, the voters are actually people who have to feed their families. They have to go to work if they can find work. They need better wages. And of course, they have to go to the doctor when they're sick. So this becomes not abstract, not sort of just election sloganeering, but it's really about people's lives. And all the distraction, whether it's about the hatred directed against Muslims or immigrants on the part of the Republicans, or hatred against the Russians on the part of the Democratic Party elites, all of that sort of fades away when it comes down to basic core issues. Is it possible that under these circumstances, under these particular circumstances, that the left, the progressive movement, the people like yourself, in popular resistance, and those in the healthcare professional advocacy circles who have been advocating for single-payer health plan, which again has been denounced as communism by the Republicans and the Democrats won't take it up. Is it possible that there could be a realignment on these core issues?
You know, I'm optimistic because, you know, in all the years that I've been fighting for a national improved Medicare for all, I have never seen this level of support coming from all areas, even very unexpected areas. Organizations that work on issues that are not directly related to healthcare are seeing this fight as a primary fight for them right now. And we're seeing increasing support. You know, a recent poll looked at Republicans and found that those who make under $75,000 a year, there was a 20% increase in their support for Medicare for All in a one-year period. So that those who are making under $25,000 are now over 50% supporting this approach. Because we've tried the market approach, and it's just been proven over and over that it fails to protect people and provide health security. So I think people are really tired of that and are ready for, you know, a real solution. They know about traditional Medicare. They've seen how that's worked for elderly members of their family. And so I think that we have an opportunity right now to really shift the political culture on this. And what was really interesting to me at the most recent town hall in Carroll County was that three of the people who got up to ask a question or make a statement made the point that healthcare is not a commodity. And I had not said anything to that effect in my comments. They came out with that spontaneously. So that, I think, shows a real shift. And if we can show that things like healthcare are not commodities, hopefully that will shift the kind of political awareness around other important necessities like education and energy and affordable housing and so many of the things that we're lacking here.
And again, just for our listeners, the people who said to you at Carroll County town hall meetings where Congress had to confront their own constituents, these are not left-wing areas. This is not San Francisco.
Right.
This is conservative. This was areas that voted for Trump.
Yeah.
Margaret Flowers, in other advanced industrial capitalist countries, there is universal health care. I'm not talking even about socialized medicine, which I personally would favor. In other words, completely
right.
Eliminate the profit motive at all from the delivery of health care services. In the case of the United States, a Medicare for All program is not socialist. It doesn't completely eliminate the profit motive, but it does guarantee that everyone has access. And it does guarantee a sort of rational system whereby people really can depend on healthcare. But even though it's not socialist, it's certainly not communist, it seems like it would almost take a revolution in America to get that simple reform, Medicare for all. Yes or no?
Well, yeah. I mean, it flies against the interests of our members of Congress who, you know, are there to serve the interests of the wealthy elites who fund their campaigns. And they have shown themselves, you know, over past decades to be incapable of really putting forward plans that protect the interests of the majority of the public. But we're seeing a real change in attitudes in the United States where people are leaving the Democratic and Republican parties, where people are starting to get more noisy, you know, noisier about these things and saying that they've been pushed to a certain limit. I mean, the wealth inequality in the United States, when you think it can't get any worse, then the next year it is worse. And so that we have 25% of our population are living in debt. And two-thirds of our population can't afford an emergency that costs $500 or more. So people get squeezed to a point, and they're going to push back. And I think that we're seeing that right now.
In our last 2.5 minutes, I want to go back and talk about the split within the Republican Party. We mentioned the Growth Caucus and Freedom Caucus. They're opposing it. Of course, Paul Ryan is supporting it. The Republican Party in the past has, as far as getting a plan together, it didn't have enough members of the party who could see eye to eye. Meanwhile, a big obstacle to winning conservative support, this is the right wing of the Republican Party, has been the issue of tax credits and how to structure them. While Paul Ryan and Price's plans both included refundable tax credits in the past, under Obamacare you got government subsidies to help pay the premium, conservatives like Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky have dismissed any kind of tax credits as nothing more than Obama light. Currently, Obamacare has a different structure of tax credits. Talk about what this indicates about the Republican Party and what are they talking about?
Well, basically, you know, they don't believe that government, I guess, should be involved in healthcare and so, or paying for healthcare. They believe that if there's this myth in the United States that if health insurance companies were allowed to compete with each other, that it would drive down the cost of premiums and the cost of care. And in fact, it's completely the opposite, because insurance companies compete to cover the healthiest patients and not pay anything out. And so, as we said earlier, it's going to drive down the cost of premiums, but the plans aren't going to actually cover anything when people get sick. And so, yeah, the Republican ideology is to try to cut federal spending, make, you know, government smaller. And what's interesting is that they've proposed a whole long list of tax cuts from the Affordable Care Act, and they're not doing any kind of budget analysis to find out how they're going to pay for the things they're proposing. And so I think we're going to see that they're going to severely underfund our health care, and it's going to cause further implosion of the system, further pressure for change. And I think that will be an advantage to continue to push for the real solution.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined by Dr. Margaret Flower. She is the co-director of Popular Resistance, as well as a pediatrician and advocate for the single-payer health system. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Today, International Women's Day is being marked around the world, including in many countries where it is an official national holiday. Here in the United States, organizers are planning a major series of demonstrations and strikes to protest the extreme sexism of the Trump administration and its policies, and moreover, to build a movement for women's liberation. We are joined from Geneva, New York, by Jody Dean. She is a professor in the political science department at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and her latest book is Crowds and Party. Welcome back, Jody.
Hi, Brian. Thanks so much.
Jody, 100 years ago today, the Russian women began a strike for bread and peace in response to the death of over 2 million Russian soldiers in World War I. According to the Julian calendar, which was a Sunday, February 23rd, that day in the Gregorian calendar is March 8th, International Women's Day. Within 4 days, the Tsar abdicated. There was a Russian revolution, the first Russian revolution in 1917, and then a second revolution. The whole world changed, and people forget that the power of that movement, that process that shook up the world, literally, started on International Women's Day. Now, you are not planning a Russian Revolution version in America today, but talk about what the women's strike is, what's going on. This is obviously a very, very dynamic situation, especially since Donald Trump became the president of the United States on January 20th.
I agree. We're not planning a revolution, but we're not going to excluding it either. And so we're hopefully preparing for it. And, you know, who knows what will happen over the next 4 days. But today, what we were hoping here in Geneva, New York, was to do a number of different things. So one of our first goals was to build from the energy from January 21st. You know, over 3 million people marched, participated in the Women's March against Trump on January 21st. So there's clearly a great deal of interest and concern and intensity right now that women and women supporters and allies have been building up. So we want to add to that. And we also want to push that in a direction that has a little bit more substance to it than just being, you know, against Trump. What we're hoping to do in our strike and in our, we're having a women's assembly here in Geneva. What we want to do is to push further discussions of violence against women and the way that violence is not just physical violence, though that's significant, but also police violence, the violence of deportation, economic violence, the violence of having one's house foreclosed, the violence of wage labor when one doesn't have, you know, child care and one's underpaid, the violence of flex work that makes people have to make really, really hard choices under the drop on a, you know, on a dime at the drop of a hat. So we're wanting in our discussions on the International Women's Day and the Geneva Women's Assembly as part of the strike, we want to further the discussion of violence against women. We want to make sure that we're all talking about labor rights. We want to make sure that we're talking about anti-racism and anti-imperialism and the rights of immigrants. We also are going to talk about full social provisioning, reproductive rights, and climate change, all things that are under threat by Donald Trump and the Republican Congress.
We're talking with Professor Jody Dean. She's in Geneva, New York. She's one of the principal organizers of a women's assembly that's going to be taking place in Geneva. Geneva's in western New York. Jody Dean, you're in a small city, Geneva, New York, but all around the country there are activities taking place. This is a dynamic time in American politics. If you said a year or two ago, well, the country is affected or infected by lethargy or lassitude or apathy, maybe so, but right now, people all across the political spectrum, and certainly people who are progressives, have been coming together, carrying out mass actions of all types. Certainly, this is something very, very unusual. And it seems to me that it's got both spontaneity and planning. You've been one of the planners. Talk about what it's been like organizing in Geneva, New York.
So there are lots of challenges to organizing in small cities and towns, particularly ones in rural areas. One of the challenges is that your cadre or your group of left people and progressive people is substantially smaller, so it's harder to get critical mass. Up here, we are in a red district with a really, really awful member of Congress. We're in New York's 23rd, and our member of Congress is such an awful Trump supporter that he didn't want Trump to have to reveal his taxes, and he supported the Muslim ban. He also has a Planned Parenthood ranking of zero and an NRA, I'm pretty sure his NRA ranking is like, you know, A triple plus. So he's a really rough guy, but he's won this district, and there are a lot of people in these rural farm communities who are mobilized primarily around guns. And so it's, you've got real challenges like that you don't have in places where you have a critical mass of left people. Another thing, though, that we do have that's interesting, that's an opportunity for organizing, is we have a large Spanish-speaking population because of the wine and apple orchards, you know, wine vineyards and apples. And so these farm workers are at high risk of deportation. And so what we've been doing to organize up here is to do all of our organizing in English and Spanish, because we hope that we can build a base point for building tighter connections with the Spanish-speaking community up here so that we can provide better deportation defense. So on the one hand, it's kind of recognizing the challenge of critical mass. On the other hand, it's been trying to work in two languages. That's been a challenge. We've also done – we've been really fortunate to get a lot of support from the small local businesses, some of which are immigrant-owned and that have really wanted to show their solidarity with the women's strike. Some have had fundraisers for us. Others are letting all their workers strike that day. And then the last thing we've done is we put together a strike fund. We recognize that now, a traditional labor strike has a strike fund to try to make sure that when workers lose their wages, they get some kind of support so that the burden of the strike isn't utterly incapacitating. This can be super challenging for a women's strike in that it's hard to know, you know, how to support women who are unwaged. And it can also be scary in the current environment for people who are really underwaged to go on strike. You know, there have been criticisms of the women's strike as somehow a strike of the privileged. Well, what we decided to do was to make sure that anyone who was burdened by the strike could get basically paid by the strike fund. They can get up to a minimum wage of $15. We are using that minimum wage for each hour that they are away from work or having to provide childcare. We're also socializing childcare and food for the day, and you know, providing kind of collective childcare that we'll all do, and providing collective food for everyone.
Joni Dean, it's natural that the left would be the initiators of the International Women's Day strike that's directed in large part against both Trump and the policies of the U.S. Congress, both the Democrats and the Republicans. But certainly it would come from people who are not necessarily Trump supporters. But the Trump supporters, a lot of folks, especially in your area, I know that area quite well because I grew up in Western New York, in Rochester, New York. They're politically conservative, but people are poor. Workers are losing their jobs. They're working second and third jobs. They don't have child care. Now that the Obamacare was in many ways, even though it expanded coverage for some, it was also came with very high premiums. Things are going to actually get worse for all working class folks who don't have enough health care. Is it possible, and is it one of the goals of your strike, of the Women's Assembly, to also reach out to the working class and poor women who may have voted for Trump or whose families may have voted for Trump? I mean, you have the issues of gender violence, reproductive justice. I mean, abortion rights are pertinent to all women of childbearing age and all girls. Is there a way to reach across and make this a way to make the red state really red or the red areas really red by bringing them into a sort of a more left perspective?
We're really hoping that by bringing in labor questions and social provision questions and an analysis of the forms that violence takes, that this will get all the women in the area to start thinking not just in terms of mainstream party politics that might make them think, well, I didn't like Hillary Clinton, so I must be a Trump supporter, or Trump is clearly against the elite and so am I. We're hoping that we can, by focusing the issues in this different way, that they will start they already know that they're in economic position. They'll start recognizing the incapacity of the mainstream political parties to grapple with them. And then they'll start to see in the kind of solidarity that we're building through the Women's Assembly, the possibility of another kind of politics, maybe a politics that's further left. So one of the ways we've been reaching out, we did flyering in and leafleting, canvassing in a housing projects area on the edge of town, went out to the laundromats and dollar stores and gas stations, you know, stood in the parking lots to make sure that we could try to get flyers to people that, you know, may not read the paper or get access from social media. We also had a big banner drop early yesterday morning to make sure that people coming to, you know, into work in the area would see that the strike's going on. And we know that some of the black churches have encouraged all of their congregation to go. And we're hoping that we'll get a high school walkout, which could help reach their parents. So in some ways, by reaching the high school students, we might get a chance to let them help reach their parents to say, you know, there are economic issues here that, you know, Trump and his Republican Party are really hurting you on.
What did the banner say? And where was it dropped?
We dropped it over 5 and 20. There's a bridge that goes from what is our South Main Street. And then you can see the 5 and 20 road down below. And we had it just announced the women's strike and then the time and place. But we had it in English and Spanish.
Joni, during the, well, before the election, but after the DNC, after the Democratic National Convention, it was obvious that Hillary Clinton was trying to appropriate the symbols, the iconography, the slogans of the historic women's movement in the United States, which, of course, was part of the struggle for the abolition of slavery, the struggle for the right of women to vote, the struggle of women workers and all workers to form unions, the rights of people to not live in poverty when they get old. Hillary Clinton tried to appropriate those, and her slogan for her campaign was, I'm with her. It wasn't even with, I'm with Hillary. It's like, I'm with her, meaning she is a woman and perhaps the first woman to have become the president of the United States. And yet a lot of women, working class women especially, and others, of course, middle class women, didn't vote for Hillary. Like, she tried to appropriate the iconography of the women's movement, but that wasn't enough. Talk about how the women's strike, the women's assembly, is approaching this issue, the issue of the Democratic Party and its appropriation of the iconography or symbolism of the women's movement. You've talked about Trump. You've talked about the Republicans. What's the role of the Democrats here?
What's so funny is, like, the Democrats are invisible. They've had, I haven't seen hide nor hair of any kind of Democratic presence or discussion or anything in relation to the women's strike, either here in Geneva, in the Western New York area, or in mainstream media. It's like they don't even know what's going on. So I think in the first place, in our local organizing, we haven't had to worry about the Democrats because no one's even thinking about the Democrats. They're just completely out of the picture. In terms of the way, I mean, actually, I could even give another example of this. A guy came up in one of our, there's regular Tuesday anti-Trump protests, and we, the Geneva Women's Assembly has participated in those as also to try to get enthusiasm going for the women's strike. And so a man came up to us trying to sell us a little figure of Hillary Clinton pointing the middle finger at someone. There was some kind of Trump caption at the bottom. And no one had any interest in it whatsoever. Like, no one is even thinking about Hillary or anything, or anything that has to do with the Democrats. Now, I think the larger issue is the way that a particular kind of elite feminism that Hillary Clinton represented expropriated the radical legacy of the women's movement and of, you know, radical feminist politics and working class women's politics and politics of women of color. And one of the things that the women's strike has emphasized from the beginning, I mean, in the national and international messaging, as well as our local messaging, is that everything is open to all genders, right? Looking at women's work lets us appreciate and understand and get insight into the problems of unpaid and undervalued labor. It lets us recognize the way that so much work today is feminized, which means it becomes invisible as work. It becomes feminized in the way we're supposed to all be smiley and caring and helpful, again, as this extra burden on us to do emotional labor that we're unpaid for. And it also, the other thing that women's work opens up to us is the ways that huge aspects of our lives exceed the capital relation, even as capital depends on it. And I'm thinking here of the care work that women can't actually strike from, right? It's not the case that they're going to be children that go with their diapers not changed for a year, or, I mean, for a day, or that, you know, the old people who need care are, you know, are left to starve for a day. That's not going to happen. And so the thing that a women's strike makes us really think about as a society is, what is it that, how is it that these kinds of labor are so crucial to reproducing our families, reproducing our ways of life, and yet capitalism only expropriates them, only fails to value them, only pushes them away in isolated places that you have to do on your own, in away from other people. So we think that the women's strike is actually an important way to recognize the limits and problems of capitalism for everyone. So it's not an identity politics at all, right? It's a radical anti-capitalist and anti-racist politics.
Right. So we have a situation where women make 70 cents to every dollar a man makes for equivalent work. But the working class as a whole, male and female, people of all genders, they're having their wages go down, down, down. That's a product of globalization. You have Trump trying to take advantage of it and redirect it into what I would say is a very reactionary political channel, scapegoating immigrants, scapegoating Muslims, scapegoating others, saying we're going to make America great again without improving wages or increasing women's rates. We're talking with Jody Dean. She's a professor in Geneva. She's an organizer with the women's strike. 100 years ago today, the women in Russia also did not anticipate that their protest would lead to the February Revolution. But that's the dynamism of politics. Jody Dean, we wish you well. We are out of time. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear, with Brian Becker for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.